And you're listening to the HR Power Hour. Today we're going to have a great guest, and he's going to be talking about, quote, an end run around Obamacare, minimizing costs of ACA compliance via partial self-funding. And the gentleman we're going to be speaking today comes to us live from Andover, Massachusetts, a town I know well, and his name is Jim Edholm, and he is the president of BBI Benefits Incorporated. And Jim, welcome to the show.
I'm delighted to be here, David.
You know, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, whatever that may be, today's terminology that is heading out there, is definitely challenging employers across the country. And this topic has been a conversation we've had many times on the HR Power Hour. You're talking about a little bit about minimizing the cost, and I think that's an incredible interest to employers across the country here in New England. What do you mean by that?
Well, if we start right from the get-go, there are if an employer is fully insured in Massachusetts, that would be Blue Cross or Harvard or Tufts or Fallon or Neighborhood Health Plan or New England Health. Right off the bat, the costs are 6 to 9% above what they'd be if they weren't fully insured. And that 6 to 9% consists of a 2% Massachusetts premium tax. So 2% of everything you pay for your health insurance, you and your employees, is going right to Massachusetts to help do more boondoggles or whatever it is Massachusetts does with. There's also a starting 1/1/14, there is a 2% federal premium tax. In addition to that, the ACA loads on mandated benefits. So there's things you have to have, like pediatric dental, but that adds about 1.5%. And then when you add the insurance company's profit is about 1 to 3%. So you add all those up, and you're up in that 6, 6.5, 7, 9% range. Now those are costs that go not toward your health care, not toward your employees' doctor's payment, nothing. It goes toward simply lining various pockets. So if you can avoid self-funding, because those same kinds of things disappear if you avoid a fully insured asset self-funding. I mean, if you avoid a fully insured premium, you avoid all of those costs. Or you can. You have that option. So that's the beginning of it. The other thing that happens, I think, is that, you know, wellness is the big term today. In HR circles, everybody is working hard to try to create a culture of wellness and put wellness programs into effect. And let's just assume for a moment that you're fully insured and you do promote the Blue Cross or the Harvard or the Tufts wellness plan, and your employees really buy into it, and they end up getting healthier and not having as many claims. Who do you think profits? Does the employer profit? No. The carrier profits, because those are claims that they had budgeted that they were going to pay for your group, but in fact your group didn't incur them, so they never pay them, but yet they collected the same premium. So it allows you, if you look at self-funding, you can avoid those taxes, you can avoid those mandated benefits, you can avoid that carrier profitability, and moreover, you can implement programs that will directly reduce your cost through greater health, through greater transparency, through a whole number of things that are available to the self-funded plan. So I'm a big believer in it. Is there risk? Yeah. But is there reward? Absolutely. The two go hand in hand.
Absolutely. So let's break this down a little bit, because obviously we're talking about a couple of different markets out there first. So let's talk about, there's a small market or the small business market that we're talking about, the large companies. Does it matter in terms of the small businesses versus the large business market?
Yes, it does. First of all, large businesses, over 200 lives, about 90% of businesses are self-funded already. They have been for years. And the reason is, you get to 200 employees, and statistically, your claims are kind of predictable. Not absolutely predictable, but they're pretty good. So you can buy the appropriate stop-loss insurance and all that sort of thing and put it into effect, and most of them do that. Between 100 and 200, probably only 50 to 70% of the people are self-funded. More of them ought to be. In that group, it's relatively easy to do self-funding because you are able to see your claims. By law, at 100 lives and up, the carrier must disclose what your claims were, what the any serious conditions that exceeded more than some dollar amount. So you're going to get a list. You know that, okay, I got these 123 people on the plan, and I got two cancers, and I got seven diabetes that were serious, and whatever. And you can make a pretty good judgment as to whether self-funding is going to make sense. Between 50 and 100 employees, you're not going to be able to get the detail on the claims that you can over 100 because they don't have to give it. However, currently, and this is changing next year, currently they do take those claims information into account when renewing your case. So if you're 73 lives or 51 lives or 99 lives, the carrier looks at what's called the manual rates, which is the rates that are just based on how old your people are, where they live, how big their families are, that sort of thing. They look at that, but then they also look at the actual claims your group incurred in the prior 12 months, and they adjust your rates up a little or down a little, depending on what your claims were. So, it still becomes easy to self-fund because there's enough data there that carriers will write a product right out of the box. You can, you know, in 30 days, you can be up and self-funded and have a pretty good feel as to what your worst-case scenario is, your best-case scenario, et cetera. Under 50, it gets a little trickier, but you are rewarded with some downside protection. It gets trickier because, generally speaking, you're going to have to medically underwrite your group. The carriers will not write a product for you, a self-funded product, without having your employees answer about 10 relatively detailed medical questions. I mean, it takes 5 minutes to fill the form out or 10 minutes to fill the form out, but they got to look at that because there's no way for them to know by the rates whether you have a lot of sick people or no sick people because the rates are all pooled. Everybody under 50 gets the same rates. By the way, starting in 2016, that's going to be everyone between under 100 will have that same thing. So you're going to have to, A, go through the pain in the neck of underwriting. The second challenge is going to be when you underwrite, what you do is you say, look, I'm willing to share risk with the carrier. That's what all of this is. You're saying, hey, I'm going to only use you, Mr. Insurance Carrier, for larger claims. I'll take care of the small stuff. If Harry goes and gets his annual physical, I don't care. I'll pay for that. On the other hand, if Harry falls down and breaks 17 bones, and spends more than $25,000 or $50,000 or some number that you, the employer, choose, then you say, I want you to step in and pay the claims in excess of that. Well, the smaller you are, obviously, the lower that trigger point is. So you're going to only maybe be willing to pay the first $10,000 of any claim. As a result, your fixed costs are going to be higher. And it's going to be a little bit harder to profit from self-funding. But as I say, you have offsetting advantage. The offsetting advantage is you're going into it knowing how healthy you are because you had medical statements. And number two, if the bottom falls out and you have a terrible year, the next year you just go back into the insurance market and you get the same rate you would have had because you're all pooled and it's all a guaranteed issue.
Speaking of that, can you halfway through? Can you join any time back into that rate if suddenly, you know, all heck breaks loose?
No. It's a one-year commitment.
It is a one-year commitment. Okay.
Yeah. But you're generally going into that. You know your worst-case scenario. In other words, they tell you, here's a cap. You're going to pay these premiums. That's a fixed cost, so you know how much that's going to be. And you're going to pay this administrative charge, so you know what that's going to be. And they say, and in the worst case, here's what you're going to pay in claims. And everything above that is going to be picked up.
I think probably the biggest scare point for any organization in self-funding is exactly that, right? That there's oh my gosh, it's going to be a fortune if suddenly someone has a catastrophic event. You know, I'm in trouble. So what you're saying is that you still buy insurance for a certain point after.
Yes, absolutely. What you want to avoid, nobody, not GM. Well, GM can't afford anything, but Google can't afford someone who gets a million and a half dollar claim. And those can happen these days. So you pick a claim size that isn't going to ruin the experience of the entire group. So for a group of 20 people or 30 people, probably $10,000, something like that. You know, you can eat the first $10,000 of any one claim. But then beyond that, you know, you want them to pick it up. The problem is that, of course, there's not a big difference between a $2,000 claim and a $10,000 claim. And as a result, that stop loss is more expensive than would be the premium if you had a $50,000 stop loss. So you're constrained a little bit. But again, typically, as a rule of thumb, I will tell you that your worst-case scenario in claims, if your claims fall out of bed entirely, typically your worst-case scenario is you're going to spend 10 to 15% more money than you would have spent if you were fully insured. But if your claims hit the expected level, and 4 years out of five, they will. At that fifth year, you're going to have a bad year every 5 years. And just assume that. Every fifth year, you're going to max out, and you're going to spend more than you would have spent fully insured. But the other 4 years, you're probably going to be 8 to 10% below what you would have paid for a fully insured plan.
So let's break this down a little bit. So I understand that we're talking about self-funding. And again, we're talking with Jim at home. He is the president of BBI Benefits Incorporated, and we're talking about avoiding Obamacare or an end run around Obamacare, minimizing costs of the ACA compliance via partial self-funding. One of the questions that come up certainly about this is, you know, we're talking about cost, right? We're talking about that. How does it affect the employee itself?
Typically, not much at all. Generally speaking, I suggest to my clients that the first year you go in, you want to basically have the same plan that you had when you were fully insured. You want to have the same deductible, the same co-pays, the same because it's going to be strange enough that they're moving from a common name, you know, the Blue Cross or the Harvard or the Tufts, and I'm using Massachusetts carriers here, but they're moving from a known, trusted name to someone that they haven't used before. It may be Aetna or Cigna or United Healthcare, and in parts of the country, those are very well-known names. So there is, you know, people are a little bit nervous about it, and so if you keep the plan design the same, then you're going to be okay. So the employee's still going to have that $20, $25 doctor copay. They're still going to have a $15, $30, $50 drug copay. They're still going to have a $1,000 hospital deductible, whatever it happens to be. So the plan design will be the same, and there therefore is no risk to the employee whatsoever.
So for transportability, someone that is going on vacation to, I don't know, taking a cruise, still going to Texas, going to Europe, going anywhere. The key is the fact that you're still using a national carrier name in the background so that hospitals and organizations will still take that information.
Yep, absolutely. All health plans must handle emergency care, must give emergency care. In the U.S., they will bill the plan. And it'll then, or the administrator will process it. You'll pay your share, and they'll pass the other off to XYZ, whoever the insurance carrier is that you've purchased. In Europe, it's a little bit different, but that's true even of a fully insured plan. In Europe, they will always bill you, and then you submit it to the carrier and get reimbursed, which is, if you have to spend $50,000, it's a problem. But typically, that's going to be a long enough thing that you'll be able to set up. You know, so the carrier will process claims as soon as they happen. But it isn't an automatic. The hospital in Europe is going to have to establish a working relationship with the insurer over here in the United States.
So. We're talking with Jim Edgecombe. He is the president. Why am I keeping on saying it wrong? I apologize. I've done three shows today, and I'm starting to talk gibberish.
Nope.
We're talking with Jim at home. He is the president of BBI Benefits Incorporated. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we will be right back. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates.
Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
They say it's never too late to be what you might have been. So if you want to turn your passion into your profession, AARP can help you find new opportunities that take advantage of Work Reimagined, a program that leverages the power of LinkedIn. AARP also provides access to tools, resources, and information that can help you at every step. Just a few of the ways AARP helps turn your goals and dreams into real possibilities.
AARP, real possibilities.
Go to aarp.org/possibilities to find tools and guidance.
Real Possibilities is a trademark of AARP.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan. Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan. Not the silver plan. Too much trouble. Do they have a stainless steel plan? I like bronze, like my tan. Are sunburns covered? Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group. Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today. We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Our sponsors for today's show, AARP, taking on issues that matter. Northern Insurance Group, meeting your business, commercial, and personal insurance needs. Sheehan Finney Bass and Green, innovative approaches and practical solutions. And the law firm of Jackson Lewis, all we do is work. And today we're talking with Jim Edholm. He is the president of BBI Benefits Incorporated in Andover, Massachusetts. We're talking about his new upcoming ebook, An End Run Around Obamacare, Minimizing Cost of ACA Compliance via Partial Self-Funding. Jim, I got to tell you, this is a very interesting topic because we've talked about the ACA in many different ways, but we haven't talked about options for employers to go out and look at different ways to avoid some of the mandates and so forth that are out there. Tell me why an HR professional, a C-suite professional out there, should do this. Tell me why they really should consider this, considering all the risks, considering all the factors involved, the good, the bad. Why should they overall do this?
Okay. First of all, and that's an excellent question, David. I appreciate your asking it, because the fact of the matter is that the HR professional has more responsibilities on his or her plate than just the financial responsibilities. That's a part of it, obviously. Everybody in management wants to try to make costs as reasonable as possible. But the HR person also has to deal with the real-life impact of the health care on the employees. And that's one of the things I think is potentially the most exciting about self-funding. It is not... You are removed from that situation with fully insured, where essentially the broker comes in and says, "Here's a menu of five options or five plans you can put. That's all you can have. You can have this plan, that plan, or that." And she says, "Well, gosh, I'd rather see a lower copay here and a higher." Well, unless you're over 50 to 100, you start to get some of that in there. But let's assume, for example, that you discover that you've got 7 or 12 diabetics on your plan, and the compliance with their medication is not that great. And you won't know, by the way, nobody's secrets are given away here. You can buy access to someone who will monitor usage, and they'll come back and say, look, let's modify your plan. Let's make it so that any diabetic medication has a zero copay, because that's going to make it easier and more affordable for your employees to control their medical condition. Now, that has a good side effect from the financial standpoint because it's going to lower the probability of someone having a diabetic attack or losing a leg to diabetes or whatever happens. And the same thing is true with high cholesterol, high obesity, et cetera, et cetera. But more importantly, the employees are going to say, holy cow, here is an employer who is working to try to make my plan as useful for me as I can, as they can. That's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it's very customizable, really. You get to customize it, yes.
You can do really whatever you want to do. And, in fact, I think that's the real secret to this thing. For example, one of the biggest things, we talked about wellness before, and, you know, you really don't get any benefit from wellness if you're fully insured. The carrier gets benefit, but you don't. Well, with an appropriate wellness, and I call it wellness with teeth, and this always isn't quite as popular with the employees, but you should do it anyhow. In wellness with teeth, what you do is you say, hey, guys, hey, I got a great news for you. Here's our contribution for next year. It's X dollars a month for the employees' cost. And, however, for those of you who choose to participate in our wellness program, it's $50 a month less. So now you're giving the employees, oh, wow, that's great. And what they then have to do is, I call it wellness with teeth because they're going to pay $600 a year if they don't participate. And if they do, they're going to get that discount. And for that, they're going to have to get with the carrier that I use or the provider I use most frequently. They're going to get a full fasting blood draw. This is something that their doctor would charge $300 or $400 if their doctor asked them to get that test. That blood will be taken, and it'll be sent off to the doctor, so the doctor gets a full test without the employee having to pay the deductible. And now you got a pretty good idea of what's going on inside the body of every single employee. When I say you, again, the HR person never knows Sally has this or Ralph has that. They just know, look, you've got five people that have high cholesterol, and you've got seven over here that have high blood pressure, whatever it happens to be. The wellness provider then goes out and reaches out in a not forcing anyone to do anything, but they reach out in a supportive way to talk to those people and help them get better health care for their condition. Again, it's a very positive thing. Moreover, a nationwide study of 22,000 employees using this system showed that typical out-of-work time for short-term disabilities was reduced by, and I'm doing these numbers from memory, but it was like 17%, and workers' comp was also likewise reduced. So you're going to improve your workers' comp experience modifier. You're going to have people out fewer, which is going to increase productivity because, let's face it, when Harry's out sick, the person who's filling in to do Harry's job doesn't do it all the time and isn't as good as Harry, so you lose efficiency. So it's going to help morale, it's going to lower turnover, it's going to increase productivity, it's going to make for a better workforce. So I think that addresses the kind of person-to-person concerns that the HR person is responsible for addressing.
No, I think you're right. I think it is an interesting option for organizations to look at in terms of being able to customize to their employee population.
Yep.
And help their employee population in certain ways. Now, I know plans have to have certain basics, correct? So,
yep.
So those, they still will get all the required functions of what a health plan, but you can't just as an employer pull something out, correct?
No. Theoretically, you can pull a lot of things out, but you do have to still meet the ACA guidelines of minimum credible coverage. So there's going to be some kind of minimum coverage level in order to pass muster under the ACA. And as I suggested in the last section, that you don't want to make a huge transition. You want to go in the first year to a plan that matches what you're doing now as closely as you can. So it's still going to be as viable and as robust a plan as you currently have. There's another thing you can do that I like, too. It's a transparency tool that I use. And again, I get paid nothing for these. I just find they're so exciting to my clients that they love having them. It's a thing from a provider that essentially gives a tool to the employee that works on a laptop computer, on a desktop computer, on an iPad, on an iPhone, smartphone. The fact of the matter is there's a huge difference in cost. For example, in Boston, the cost of a colonoscopy within the greater Boston area ranges from $1,150 to $3,875. And we're talking a huge spread, and it's the same procedure no matter where you go. So, and typically, except for preventive colonoscopies, so if there's something wrong, it's not preventive, it's diagnostic, it typically is going to go against the deductible, and the employee is going to pay it. So this thing allows the employee to take his smartphone, click in that he has to go get a colonoscopy, and just like that, up will pop 12 locations within 10 miles of his house, and they're coded red, yellow, and green. And the green ones are the ones that are have the highest quality and the lowest cost. And typically what the employer does is sponsor something where if the employee chooses a green-coded facility, he gets $50 cash. So now all of a sudden the employee says, gee whiz, this is a preventive colonoscopy, so I'm going to pay nothing. But golly, if I use this guy, this little tool, I'm going to get $50 in cash I can do whatever I want with. Again, it drives down cost because the fair price that's coded green is $1,750. So instead of spending $3,800 or the $2,400 average, you're going to spend $1,700 or less. That helps the employee, helps the employer, and again, puts some cash in your employee's pocket.
Well, we're talking about, obviously, how it helps and benefits the employee, and I do absolutely see that the HR professional and the organization would see that that is a benefit to them. How does it help the organization from a cost perspective? The CFO looks at it, the CEO looks at it and goes, yes, we have some risk, but overall, maybe over that five-year period, what are they talking about in terms of dollar savings or percentage savings in terms of overall health care?
If they put in the wellness program, and they put in the transparency programs that they should put, in general, over a five-year period, they are going to be 10 to 20% below what they would have spent had they remained fully insured. That's a pretty big, bold statement.
It is.
It's certainly not a guarantee. You know, I can't guarantee that's going to happen because, like I said before, every fifth year, you're going to have a bad year. But, in fact, that's a law of large numbers, and that's a good rule of thumb. You're going to spend 10 to 20% less over 5 years than you would have spent had you remained fully insured. In fact, in that nationwide study I talked about on the wellness thing, it actually showed that the trend factor, this is 22,000 employees, 57 employers, compared against a statistically matched group of non-participating, non-wellness providing employers. The non-wellness over a three-year period had a 12.2% trend, so 12% per year over, and the guys with the wellness program had a 5.9%. So it was less than half. Interesting enough, in the third year of that program, actual medical costs for this whole group of 22,000 people went down by 7.7%. So it works. You got to stick with it. You have to promote it. And again, that's where the HR department comes in. They're the people that talk to the folks on the line. And so it will work, and it will drive down your costs if you give it time. But you got to stick with it, and you got to make it a management program, a team approach. You got to build it into your culture.
Yeah, you know, you have to build it into everyday discussions. Yep. You have to build it into what you're doing, what you're saying, and that's the way only programs work, anyways, right? I mean, people have to be committed
Precisely.
To it,
exactly.
And you have to incentivize it to make people believe that that's important for them.
Yep.
You know, Jim, we're kind of talking about something that probably people are familiar with, you know, self-funding. But I know there are a lot of groups out there that sometimes get together and self-funding groups. Is this where an organization can look at something like this and tie in with others to do this in a group format?
Yes, in some industries, yes. However, I always worry a little bit about association groups, and the reason is they often enter into what I call the death spiral. Typically what they do when you do that, they blend it all together, and everybody sort of gets the same rate, and it's lower than fully insured. But then what happens is the youngest, healthiest groups, somewhere maybe a year into it, say, well, you know what, we ought to see what we can do on our own. And they go out, and lo and behold, the youngest, healthiest group find out that they can get it cheaper. So they withdraw from the association group, and they buy their health insurance outside. Well, now you're left with the slightly older, slightly less healthy people, so the rates go up a little bit. So the next year, the next level of healthiness drops out. So it keeps getting worse and worse and worse after that. Now, there's some places that doesn't happen. The Mass Banking Association, for example, has had a blended group product for years, and it's very cost competitive, and it works very well for them. So, yeah, it can work for groups. There is a thing called a captive, which essentially is an affiliation of like-minded employers, and it may have 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 employees with 50 or 100 or 200 employers. And what they do is you're still all individually rated, and you still carry your own risks. But what you do is you pool that reinsurance risk from, say, the $10,000 or $20,000 you're starting at up to about $250,000. So instead of giving it to that premium to some carrier who goes away and could care less how healthy, you're keeping it amongst yourselves, and the profits from the self-funding the stop-loss insurance are shared among the members of the captive. That's a very intriguing way to look at it. It's kind of like a group, but yet you're still on your own. Now, I like that better,
In terms of making it happen. Well, I got to tell you, Jim, you've brought something forward that I think listeners today have not necessarily maybe thought of. And certainly it's a new idea in terms of for the show. We haven't brought it on this show, and I appreciate you bringing it forth today. If somebody wants to get a hold of you, other than the fact that we're going to certainly have all the information on the HRPowerHour.com website after this, Jim's information, his contact information, and a download of this book. It's called An End Run Around Obamacare, Minimizing Cost of the ACA Compliance via Partial Self-Funding. How can they get a hold of you, Jim?
The best bet is to drop me an email, and my email address is jedholm, that's J-E-D-H-O-L-M, at BBI Benefits, that's Boy Income Benefits, plural, .com. And, by the way, I've been talking about Massachusetts. That's where I practice. I do some work in New Hampshire, a little bit in Maine. But, in fact, any of your listeners from anywhere in the country can feel free to write to me. I'll be glad to, A, answer questions from anybody, anywhere, I don't care. And, B, if they would like an introduction to someone who is probably as involved in this and as knowledgeable in this as I am around the country, I belong to several national association of brokers that are like me, and we swap ideas and thoughts and strategies and so forth. So if you happen to be in Dry Gulch, Montana, I probably know a guy down the road that I can send you to who can help you with this. So I'd be glad to help.
Well, thank you very much, Jim, for being on the show today. We appreciate this information. I appreciate you being a guest today. And now the HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group. Licensed agents in 28 states, business, commercial, and personal. Go to northerninsurancegroup.com. According to Stephen Bruce on trendhr.com, there are 7 deadly sins that supervisors are currently doing, probably in your organization. And we're going to talk about them here today. First, sin number 1, lust. That's right. Sexual harassment continues to be a problem in the workplace, and it often worse when it's a manager and a subordinate. Perhaps the most difficult challenge in training managers and supervisors about harassment is getting across the idea that what matters is the attitude of the receiver of the harassment, not the deliverer. Managers think they can excuse their improper behavior with, quote, "I was just kidding," or "Can't she take a joke?" unquote. But if the victim was offended, and especially if he or she asked for the behavior to stop, then there's a problem. The second sin is wrath. Anger isn't appropriate in the workplace. Employees are sure to do things that make managers angry. Ask for leave at the busiest time of the year. Complain about the manager to the EEOC, for example. But the reaction must be controlled. Sin number 3, gluttony. Managers just keep taking on more and more, thinking, "I'm the manager. I can do this. I can solve this." But eventually, they can't, and the critical duties fall upon those who are filling in the cracks. Sin number 4, pride. quote, no employee of mine is going to get away with that, unquote, is a typical manager's reaction when one of his or her employees makes a claim of discrimination or refuses to work because of a perceived safety issue, or maybe even complains about harassment itself. And it's an understandable reaction, but it's also evidence for a charge of retaliation. From that moment on, take any action against that employee. Make it happen. Number 5, sin of envy. Envy makes managers do things that aren't appropriate for the company. For example, empire building, or trying to add more positions that aren't important for the company to achieve its goals. Copycatting. The other department head does it, so why shouldn't I have that French-speaking assistant? Sin number 6, greed. One way managers and supervisors show the sin of greed is their quest for information about people's lives. They start with, tell me about your childcare, family plans, what church do you go to? Tell me about your health, your age, or assorted other questions that aren't appropriate. They start innocently. Maybe they do care, but it is a recipe for disaster and can cause a lawsuit. Sin number 7, sloth. Well, be honest with you, we don't know any HR pros who aren't busy, and we're reluctant to accuse any of sloth, but we do know many who have just the basic upkeep chores on the back burner. From hiring to firing appropriately in a timely manner, HR duties are never easy. So those are your 7 sins. Don't let them happen to you or in your organization. And that's your HR tip of the week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group at northerninsurancegroup.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're bringing back a great guest, James Reedy. He is the employment attorney and chair of the Labor and Employment Law Group at Sheehan Finney Bass and Green, a great HR Power Hour sponsor. We're bringing him back because he's going to be talking 2 things. First, he's going to be giving us an update on legal law issues that are happening in New Hampshire and throughout Northern New England. And he's going to be talking about a forum that Sheehan Finney produces called the NH Labor Net. He's going to be talking about questions that come up and great answers that have been given. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.